Students often daydream about not being in school, but One Valley District may make that a reality once a week. Why? Money.
It would be an option that would have ripple effects across our community. However, we are exploring it because we feel it may be a last resort.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, cutting class to cut the budget. Also, state lawmakers are looking to give residents more of their income taxes back. But how will they close the deficit?
Keeping an eye on your elected officials could get much harder.
Trying to get more women decision makers involved in theater.
And so you say you want to be a ninja warrior.
That's it. I hurt my hands.
Plus, the truth is out there.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ along with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Look for partly sunny skies to last throughout the afternoon. We're looking for a high of 82 degrees, a few degrees warmer than yesterday. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 81. Right now, partly cloudy skies, 77 degrees.
A citrus quarantine designed to prevent the spread of a disease-carrying insect has reached Maricopa County. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, the quarantine range now covers more than 22,000 square miles in Arizona.
The bug known as the Asian citrus psyllid was first detected in Arizona in 2009. The pest has now been found in Gila Bend. That area is the first part of Maricopa County to be added to the quarantine list. The quarantine restricts the movement of potential carriers of the insect that can spread a fatal citrus tree disease. John Caravetta is with the Arizona Department of Agriculture.
If we don't have the insect, we can't move very easily citrus greening disease, which does not occur in Arizona, but is a big problem affecting the major industries in Florida and Texas in particular.
The quarantine patches can be found across the southern and western parts of the state, including areas in Mojave, Yuma, and Santa Cruz counties. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's gas prices are up again this week. AAA Arizona says the average statewide price for a gallon of regular unleaded is $2.19. That's an increase of more than 11 cents from last week. This week's national average is $2.27 a gallon, up by more than 4 cents from last week. Tucson has Arizona's lowest average gas price at $2.05 a gallon. Flagstaff has the highest at $2.30. Across the continental U.S., Utah has the lowest average gas prices, with California having the highest.
In recent weeks at the state capitol, Arizona's House Republicans decided that holding closed-door meetings was okay, especially when so-called personal issues needed to be discussed. And Governor Doug Ducey's administration got rid of a visitor sign-in log outside of his ninth-floor office, though it has since been rescinded. So what's going on? Do Arizona's elected officials think they have more to hide? Arizona Republic Capitol reporter Mary Jo Pitzel explains.
It feels like that there is a suspicion about why everything needs to be so open. And some of those things are not going to advance. A lot of these concerns, especially in legislation, are directed more towards privacy concerns. They're talking about crime victims or police officers who, you know, might be the target of some kind of spite from people that they've arrested, or judges, or vulnerable children, scrubbing their names from the public record if they've been abused or in neglectful situations. So there's a drive to protect privacy, probably fueled by a lot of what we've been seeing with the explosion of the internet. And then secondarily on process, I think just a suspicion that, you know, does all this need to be open? But those efforts don't usually get very far, and we revert to the status quo, where at least at the legislature, you know, a lot, except for the budget, except for the crucial decisions on bills, a lot of the work is done pretty publicly.
When Republican lawmakers decided to have a close caucus, at least at the House level, what were they aiming for? Did they say why they wanted that?
They said that they needed some time and some space to open. It's what we always hear. They need, you know, the space to sort of openly hash out differences and figure out their positions on things without having people posture for the media or the cameras.
When we hear about the stories that are going on today, does it remind you of anything in the past? Does it feel like these are cyclical as far as whether government and lawmakers want more or less privacy?
Yeah, I do think it's cyclical. This year we have, in the House of Representatives, one-third of the members are brand new. There's a new leadership team. So there's sort of a acclimation process. Like, you know, new people come in and they're surprised that reporters can just walk up and talk to them. They forget that they're public officials and that they were out, you know, openly campaigning for this office. So that's part of it. I will say, in a nod to the House, there had been a fair bit of restricted access for journalists who cover the Capitol at the House up until this year, and they've lifted those restrictions. And I think it becomes a comfort level. And so far, I haven't heard a lot of pushback from the new members. They understand it, that, you know, that part of the job is, you know, explaining why they're doing what they're doing.
For most of the past couple of decades, there have been a few exceptions, but there has been certainly one party that has dominated the legislature. Does it feel like that is a one-sided thing, or if Democrats had power, they might have the same sort of sketchiness about being open about things?
That's sort of a thought experiment, because Republicans have been, you know, in the majority for, you know, for a very, very long time. And for example, when the media lost their press room over at the state Senate building about, now it's been about 6 years, you know, that was under Republican leadership, and the Democrats were quick to say, "Well, if we were in charge, we would make space for you." But, you know, would they? It looks different when you're in charge. And, you know, that bell's been rung. The media moved out of the Senate building where we're in quarters that are a little farther away, but we're still out here every day.
Arizona Republic reporter Mary Jo Pitzel talking to us from her desk near the state capitol.
So how do Arizona's open government laws compare to other states? For answers, we turn to Emily Shaw. She's national policy manager for the Sunlight Foundation in Washington, D.C. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan group focused on increasing public access to government information.
Arizona has a number of decent provisions in place, and in fact, your current open meetings law has a number of good rules that other states we're hoping will emulate. Your rules about posting information and just the strictness with which the law is policed is really something that's admirable and to be lauded. So we were, of course, pretty concerned when we saw SB 1435 coming down, which aims to essentially eliminate open meetings, at least those that don't include votes from the state, you know, including at the local level. And that's the level that so many people like to know that they can access.
Is that something that any other states have done?
I haven't seen it, no. It's the most extreme that I've seen.
Have states been taking up open meeting, open government type laws in the last couple of years?
It's pretty consistent that different rules seek to expand or contract the Sunshine Laws, so, you know, either with regard to the public records or open meetings. And in New Mexico, I've been watching some movement recently. For example, I know that there's a representative who's putting forward a bill to mandate the webcasting of all committee meetings in the legislature. So that would be, you know, in the other direction, you know, increasing access to meetings to people who are unable to get to the state house.
What drives discussion and debate and sometimes enactment of laws like these?
You know, I mean, I think that it's a struggle between people who would like to access legislative processes and know what's happening in government, and maybe government officials who feel less comfortable with that kind of scrutiny. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine why anybody would want to limit, you know, access to the official public discussions that are determining how laws and other kinds of rules will work in a place. I mean, the goal of Sunshine Laws is to, you know, allow the public to see how the public's work is being done. And so maybe it's because of professional bias, but I have a hard time understanding the converse argument.
Do you find that laws like this and the discussion and debate about them tends to be somewhat cyclical, that there's a wave of, okay, let's open everything up, and then there's a wave of, okay, we need to maybe close a few things down, and then it sort of goes back and forth?
I don't know that I've observed that pattern, but you do, I think, probably see more reaction in the records exemption. So, you know, when you think about public records, that might be something that would be more likely to see a kind of expansion and contraction phase.
Emily Shaw is National Policy Manager for the Sunlight Foundation. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Peoria Unified School District is looking into cutting a day out of its school week. It's put together a team to consider the feasibility of moving to a four-day week. The move is in response to proposed cuts to K-12 education at the state capitol. Danielle Airy is the Director of Public Relations for the Peoria Unified School District.
We'll be looking at transportation, food service, the general impact on student achievement. So we'll be doing a lot of research and a complete literature review to determine if there is any impact. In addition, we'll look specifically at cost savings. Obviously, that would be the most important component to look at. We'll also be looking at an employee survey and a parent survey. So those have already gone out to those respective groups, and we've asked that they weigh in on this particular issue. Their feedback is extremely important to us. So there's a variety of aspects that are going into this. Obviously, it would be an option that would have ripple effects across our community. However, we are exploring it because we feel it may be a last resort. We're unfortunately in a position where we may have to make some significant cuts to our budget if the governor's proposed budget is passed.
Would you be looking at this absent the governor's budget proposal?
You know, we're always looking for efficiencies. In fact, over the past couple of years, it's something that was on our radar. Obviously, because of the magnitude of the impact, it was a path that we were hoping to avoid going down. But at this time, we feel we're now back in a position where we may have no choice but to go down this path. We think this idea, while it may sound, you know, very much outside the box and a little innovative and maybe a little questionable, we think it's something that could lessen the impact on the classroom, and that's why we feel we owe it to our community to take a long, hard, fast look at it.
Does the district have a sense or even maybe a goal of how much money it would save by going to this 4-day week?
You know, we don't have exact numbers yet because that is a part of our study and what we're working to determine. However, we are simply looking at a simple 5-day school week and know that if we cut 20% from there, that there may be additional savings on things like energy costs from utilities on that last day. Also, when you take into account transportation, we have a district that encompasses about 150 square miles, so that's a significant number of bus runs. There also may be quite a bit of savings around food service. Again, those numbers just aren't there for us just yet. It's still a part of our study.
If the district decides to go to 4 days, would those 4 days become longer days for students?
The days would likely become longer. We don't know how long yet. They likely would not be as long as, you know, many people think of a 4-day schedule and they say 4 tens. We don't believe it'd be 4 10-hour days for students. That obviously would be quite challenging for them to be able to stay focused. And we want to take student achievement and their overall well-being into account.
If the district decides not to go with the 4-day week, what are some of the other areas in which you might be able to cut?
If the district does not move forward with a 4-day schedule, we would be looking at areas of non-classroom expenses per Governor Ducey's budget. So we would be required to make reductions that we think would be $3 to $5 million in those areas.
Danielle Airy with the Peoria Unified School District. Danielle, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And the district expects to finish its study in the middle of next month and announce a decision shortly thereafter. Peoria Unified is not the only district that's either looking into a 4-day week or has already gone in that direction. Jonathan Plucker is an endowed professor in the School of Education at the University of Connecticut. He says the idea's popularity ebbs and flows with the economy.
Right now, we're starting to see more and more buzz about it, and I think it's because a lot of school district budgets are being hit hard again for some reason. And so we are sort of seeing at least a small flurry of interest.
And do districts tend to save the amount of money they think they're going to save?
In our estimation, from simulations that we've run and from other studies that people have done, the answer is almost always no. You know, it's really easy to look at it and say, hey, you're going to be closed 20% of the time that you used to be open. You're going to save 20%. But it never works out that way, in part because most public school district spending is in personnel, right? And personnel are pretty much working the same number of hours. They're just working a different number of days. Many districts also don't seem, interestingly enough, to save as much on the physical plant, if you will, as they would expect. I've seen estimates between about 1.5% to 5% is what gets saved. I think 10% is very optimistic. 5 or less is probably a bit more accurate.
What kind of impact does having one fewer day than what we normally have had traditionally in a school day have on students and what they're able to learn and retain and how well they do?
That, in the end, is really the most important question, right? And There's a very big limitation here, and that's that we don't have great research on this. But the research that we do have is fairly mixed. There was a recent study in 2012 that suggested that it was a do-no-harm sort of situation. So if you're saving a little money and you're doing no harm, that's good news for the four-day school week. Other studies, at best, suggest that we know that students being out of school doesn't help with achievement, obviously, right? And so taking a three-day weekend, if that's how you do it every single week, that essentially means that students who may be struggling are essentially out of school almost as long as they're in school every single week.
When you're looking at student achievement related to the number of days in a school week, do you use the same metrics that are typically used to measure student achievement, like test scores and grades and things like that? Or is there something else that you can look at specifically in this area?
People tend to use the same metrics. But your question begs the question, begs another question about, do you teach and do students learn the same way when you're there for a longer period of time? Time is generally the one thing that teachers never have enough of, right? If you have a longer day and you have these longer blocks of time, there is the potential for teachers to teach differently. You know, an extra 90 minutes may allow you to get into a certain amount of depth that you normally couldn't if, say, you can only cover a topic for 30 or 40 minutes.
Is there any research that looks at the effect of kids and perhaps their families as well outside of the classroom when schools go to four-day weeks?
You know, this actually is something that comes up frequently. Again, we don't have great data on it, but school districts do seem to consider the fact that just because there's not school on, say, a Thursday or a Friday, parents still have to work, families still have to work, children still need supervised care. And so some critics of the four-day school week have pointed out that if families then have to go and find paid child care, you're essentially passing some of the costs of the child's education back to the family. In my experience, one of the reasons why districts think about it and states think about it and don't do it is because of those other costs.
Jonathan Plucker is an endowed professor in the NEAG School of Education at the University of Connecticut. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new effort has begun to get more women taking leadership in the theater world.
Most of the ticket buyers are female, but you look at who's programming, who's behind the scenes for the executive leadership, and also who's directing the productions. It's a lot more men.
How to bridge the theater gap? It's the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic right now, an accident on the 202 eastbound, the Red Mountain Freeway at Stapley. Also an accident I-10 westbound at 7th Street. That is blocking the shoulder. The partly sunny skies that are outside right now should stick around for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 82 degrees. It's still well above average. 71 is average for today. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Partly to mostly sunny for both tomorrow and Saturday with highs each day in the lower 80s. Right now in Phoenix, under partly sunny skies, 77 degrees at KJZZ at 222.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Boys Choir. This year's classical concert, Crowning Glory, is this weekend. It highlights music performed during coronation ceremonies, including the premiere of Napoleon's coronation as emperor. Boyschoir.org.
Arizona's lawmakers have gotten used to staring at enormous budget deficits. There was a short respite, but now they're trying to figure out ways of dealing with a $500 million hole. Earlier this week, Republican senators and representatives advanced a bill that would adjust the state's tax brackets every year to account for inflation. Democrats argue that hurts revenues at a time the state could use all the funds it can get. We spoke with Steven Slavinsky and Scott Bollier of the Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU about dealing with cutting taxes and/or spending in tough budget times.
I do think that there's probably a blind side in the budget process, wherein there rarely is a reckoning with a kind of a what you might going to call sort of what's the most effective use of the money being used, right? And so there's very little long-term planning for the budget, and there's also very little time, frankly, to sit down and really weigh which specific line items should make the cut and shouldn't. And so I think for the long-term question, part of it does become a little easier, because if you're going to be making tax policy for the purpose of reinvigorating long-term planning, what you want to do is, if you have a sliding scale downward, say for a corporate income tax, you want to try to keep that intact if possible, because you've got a lot of corporations who are making plans for the future based on what they believe current law to be. And so you actually might short circuit some of the really useful economic growth potential of these cuts if you try to freeze them. But it also doesn't mean that you can't find ways of possibly, as I say, paying for these cuts in other ways. And I actually think that too much of the tax reform debate has gotten swallowed up in the idea of, is something going to be a revenue cut or a revenue increase? I think you can still do really good tax policy in a revenue neutral fashion, meaning no change in revenue, if you look at exactly what we're doing with the tax programs generally. I happen to think that a lot of the tax credits that we have in the system right now are basically just net transfers and giveaways to corporations for doing things they probably would have done anyway, even without the tax credit.
Scott, to you on this one, what are the dangers of going full bore on tax cuts in a period where there's a huge budget deficit?
We have cases where people went full steam ahead on tax cutting without really recognizing that tax cuts is just one half of the coin, which also includes spending. North Carolina is an example where they seem to be doing this right. They've gone a little more gradually, but there's very clear, transparent ideas about how they're going to flatten the tax code, how they're going to have just more growth-enhancing policies. There are triggers if the revenue comes up short of what was expected, but they seem to have gotten their house in order first on the budget before saying we're going full steam ahead with tax cuts because we believe in tax cuts.
Steve, why can't these spending cuts, which may hurt a lot of people, why can't they be gradual in the way that tax cuts are often phased in?
It's generally not doable only in the context of very dramatic swings in revenue flows relative to what the expenditure side is. And part of the reason that you get, in any state, frankly, and Arizona is not alone, you get to a position where you get these massive deficits, unexpected deficits, is because during the boom periods, you were not good at all at restraining the overall spending growth rate. So part of it comes down to a political cultural concern, and that is in the state capital, when you've got a boom period, where you start seeing the business cycle as being going to be perpetual. And so as a result, you're not going to really plan for a rainy day, as they say. And that's why we have what they call budget stabilization funds, or more commonly known as rainy day funds. You are going to have rainy days eventually. And so part of the question becomes, once we set up the budget in the current short term for structural soundness and balance, I think we really need to be making sure we have long-term structural balance as well. And so thinking beyond just a 1 or even 2 year cycle.
Do economists at that government level think about the social implications, the emotional implications, or does it really just have to be about, guys, we've got to get down to this number, this budget has to be balanced?
A lot of it does come down to just the nuts and bolts of making the numbers equal over time or over the budget cycle. And that's an important thing because there is a constitutional requirement to do so. The other question then becomes, though, if you're going to be doing that, are there other ways that these services might be provided by, say, someone that maybe the private sector, for instance, or alternatives to government provisioning of these things? And these are broader reform discussions that I think are generally often precipitated by deficit situations.
I think you'd find most economists saying that fairness and some kind of equity in who's paying, like their fair share, is very important. So when you can get there and you can show that revenue equals expenditures, then you can start to have a conversation about, gosh, these taxes are really hurting the poor. One example, I came here from Alabama. They're one of maybe 9 states, and I don't know where Arizona is at on this, that fully hits people with grocery taxes. This is very hard on the poor. It's, you know, an 8.5% tax in many cases on, you know, bananas and apples, and the poor spend a disproportionately large share of their income on food. I was on the record saying this is a tax that should just go away because regardless of what it does from a budgetary standpoint, it's just really hurting them and the economy is so weak. It's a much easier case to make if revenue is close to expenditure rather than say, well, it's going to open up a $300 million hole. When you get there and you're not dealing with $500 million deficits and huge, huge budgetary holes, the poor, I think, if anything, deserve to have a higher seat at the table than anyone else.
Scott Bollier and Stephen Slavinsky are with the Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU's W.P. Carey School.
Pink diamonds are among the world's rarest jewels. Last October, a new world record was set at an auction in Hong Kong when an 8.41-carat pink diamond sold for more than $17.5 million. That's more than $2.1 million per carat.
But in spite of their value, nobody knows for certain why pink diamonds are pink. Scientists at the Smithsonian in D.C. are hoping a collection of gems from Australia may unlock the mystery. The BBC's Jane O'Brien went to find out more.
So this is our vault area for the mineral collection, also the gem vault.
Jeffrey Post, curator of the National Gem Collection, is taking me behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum.
And so we pulled into this space about 20,000 mineral specimens that we consider to be higher value or more unique or more special than the rest of our reference collection.
We're here to see the latest addition to the collection, a cache of pink diamonds from the Argyle mine in Western Australia.
You see the typical sort of lot of light brown to champagne colored diamonds with a few really beautiful pink diamond crystals mixed in, which is, of course, what they're most famous for are the beautiful pink diamonds that come from that mine.
Pink diamonds are among the world's most valuable jewels. They can fetch more than $2 million a carat. But Jeffrey Post is more interested in their scientific value. He's hoping they'll help him find out why pink diamonds are pink.
There are a lot of different colored diamonds out there. There are blue diamonds like the Hope Diamond. There are green diamonds. There are yellow diamonds. As scientists, I can tell you why a yellow diamond is yellow. It's a little bit of nitrogen in the diamond. I can tell you why a blue diamond is blue. It's a little bit of boron in the diamond. I can't tell you why a pink diamond is pink. And it's a little bit exasperating when the highest price per carat gemstones in the world are being sold and everybody's talking about them and everybody loves them, and yet you can't tell people why they're pink.
Scientists are examining the Argyle diamonds using a mass spectrometer. Physicist Kiel Byrne explains.
We are trying to find out if there is anything other than carbon that contributes towards making these pink diamonds pink. We are basically counting every individual atom we can liberate off the surface of these diamonds, how many and what type of atoms we are detecting.
Now, when you say you're liberating atoms, what exactly does that mean? How do you do that?
We direct a very high energy ionized beam at the surface of our diamonds. This excites the atoms at the diamond surface, provides them with enough energy to break free, and they travel into the instrument and towards the detector.
The problem is scientists haven't detected any impurities that may be turning the diamonds pink. They're now speculating that the colour is due to molecular changes caused by some kind of seismic shock, possibly as the diamonds were being thrust to the surface by volcanic action. Jeffrey Post again.
The result of that shock causes a deformation, and those defects, they can actually trap electrons which can cause light to be absorbed, and that can then give rise to the color. What we can't find so far is the exact kind of defect or that we can relate directly to the pink color.
And so the mystery continues, perhaps adding to the allure of a jewel that continues to cause its own shockwaves at auctions around the world.
That's the BBC's Jane O'Brien at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jake Fenwick, and I just take care of the stadium field. I mean, you got to make it not only great to play on, but also nice for everyone to come in and look at. I mean, you want that wow factor. Especially with all the other spring training fields, you kind of want to separate yourself from the other one so people have that experience when they come here. And so I'm adding turfs to just kind of make the field have a little more vibrant look. I grew up playing in the dirt as a little boy, so nothing's really changed.
That's Jake Fenwick preparing the baseball diamond at Peoria Sports Complex. Pitchers and catchers for all of the Valley Spring training clubs arrive by tomorrow, with the full rosters in next week. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to back us off the plate, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
Coming up, have we been visited by beings from other planets, or are UFOs too weird to be true?
The weird person is the person who thinks we are alone.
We meet some people who don't think aliens are such a far-out concept. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show with Mark. I'm Steve. We have partly cloudy skies around the valley at this hour. They'll stay with us tonight when we'll see overnight lows in the lower to mid-50s. It'll be partly to mostly sunny to end the week with a high of 81 tomorrow. Then heading into the weekend on Saturday, look for a high of 82. All those temperatures at least 10 degrees above normal. Currently, we have relative humidity at 15%, and it's partly cloudy, 77 degrees at KJZZ. To the Valley Freeways, there is one accident. It's on the 202 eastbound at Stapley, and another one just snuck in. I-10 westbound at 7th Street. That one's blocking the shoulder.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, with an executive MBA for senior leaders, ranked 13th in the world by the Wall Street Journal. Open house Saturday, February 21st. Registration at execopenhouse.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. At a summit on violent extremism at the White House today, President Obama urged representatives from 65 countries to confront warped ideology espoused by terror groups.
Nations need to break the cycles of conflict, especially sectarian conflict, that have become magnets for violent extremism.
Obama urged Arab nations in particular to stop sectarian violence and boost economic and educational opportunities for young people. The president also said the idea that groups like the self-declared Islamic State represent Islam is a falsehood that he says everyone has a responsibility to refute. Some 20,000 Georgians woke up to cold, dark houses this morning after a winter storm struck earlier this week. The number is falling as power companies work to restore power. And although other parts of the country have it much worse, that's little consolation for many people in areas like Metro Atlanta. John Lawrence from member station WABE has more.
The cold wind literally takes your breath away. Atlanta resident Jasmine Downs says she's had her fill of winter.
It's awful. And you know what's funny? My door is frozen this morning. That was the crazy part. I have a patio door. I couldn't swipe it open. I was like, this is crazy.
Jennifer Brookings moved to Atlanta 10 years ago, partly to get away from weather like this.
Yes, this is just as bad as Michigan. I might as well go back.
But others, like Jerry Crawford, take this blast of winter in stride.
It's a little cold, but, you know, cold weather's fun. It's different.
The National Weather Service says parts of North Georgia could see snow and sleet Friday afternoon through Saturday morning. For NPR News, I'm John Lawrence in Atlanta.
Wall Street in mixed territory by the closing bell. The Dow down 44 points to end at 17,985. The Nasdaq was in positive territory, gaining 18 points to close at 4924. S&P 500 down 2. This is NPR.
The world of theater is typically considered to be one that's open to new ideas, creativity, and both males and females. But the Valley-based Bridge Initiative got started in order to shine the spotlight on the fact that women aren't getting the same opportunities on stage or behind the scenes that men are. Brenda Jean Foley is a co-founder of the Bridge Initiative.
There's actually a statistic in the New York Times that came out a couple years ago that in 2014, every single nominee for the Pulitzer Prize was a female. But that same year, there wasn't a single new play by a woman on Broadway. So it's not just something that's happening here in Arizona. It's a national problem, and other cities are jumping on board. Washington, D.C. actually has an initiative this year that they're having 50%. They're trying to do 50% of their plays. All the bunch of theaters have signed on to have female productions, female-helmed productions, and written productions.
I'm glad you brought the statistic with you, because I think it's probably a topic that people wouldn't necessarily think of, because I think a lot of people think, well, the theater is actually a realm where there are different kinds of parts, different kinds of roles, but perhaps we're thinking too much just about the actors as opposed to those who are directing or putting together things behind the scenes. Is there a difference there?
Absolutely. Actually, when you see the statistics about audience, most of the audience is female. Most of the ticket buyers are female. Mm. But you look at who's programming, who's behind the scenes for the executive leadership, and also who's directing the productions. It's a lot more men. Who's writing the plays? It's a lot more men. And actually, even when you look at casts, there's a lot of plays that are very male-driven. So we're just trying to put the lens to this problem.
Right. I know you're trying to open up the conversation, but do you yourself have any thoughts about why that would be the case?
There's issues as a female in any realm. You get to a certain point, and they always talk about the glass ceiling. I think I'm personally a mother, and I think that at when you reach a certain age, you have some choices to make in terms of the use of your time. And so you're looking at less and less women in, again, these leadership executive positions. And so I don't want to say that it becomes a boys' club, because that seems like it does a disservice to everyone. But I do think that there is... there's a challenge in empowering younger women to see themselves growing past, oh, this is a fun high school play that I'm, you know, getting some kind of personal satisfaction from, into the broader, I can serve in many capacities in the theater realm.
Do there need to be more mentors out there? Do there need to be better examples for women to follow?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up. One of the things that we want to address is from the education, there's so many schools here. There's so many universities, colleges that have programs. And it seems that there is a little bit of a lack of mentorship from that academic world into the professional world. And we'd like to, it's one of the reasons we call ourselves The Bridge. We'd like to create a bridge for some of those students who are looking to do some internships when we produce a play. And just to start to show these younger women that there are women who are in positions of power, who have artistic director positions or director positions, and to model it for them.
And this starts at the smallest community theater and works its way all the way up?
It absolutely does start all the way from the community theater to the professional. When we counted all of the producers in the Valley from community, semi-professional, professional, there's like 1 in 4 leadership positions are held by women.
Brenda Jean Foley is a co-founder of the Bridge Initiative, which will hold its first public discussion Sunday afternoon at Mesa Encore Theater's Black Box.
You may recall that Arizona has its own history with cryogenics and preserving humans and some parts of their bodies. Remember baseball legend Ted Williams and Scottsdale-based Alcor? The San Diego Zoo also freezes the DNA of some of its animals. The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick has more.
At the San Diego Zoo, when an endangered species dies, they run out and harvest and freeze its genetic material. Then they file it away in a lab they call the Frozen Zoo. And that's just what they did with Anjelifu, a northern white rhino, when he died at 44 back in December. Only 5 northern white rhinos remain, and researchers want that DNA. Critics say the problem is about habitat, not about daring rescue of rhinos. Dr. Barbara Durant is director of reproductive physiology at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, and she disagrees with the skeptics.
We are not in the business of bringing back T-Rex or woolly mammoth. We are in the business of bringing back animals that are living, that are on the brink of extinction due to human interference. We have a real responsibility to save them from extinction, to save the genetic diversity. Biodiversity on this planet is the most important resource we can save.
Let's say in the case of the northern white rhino, only 5 of them are living. You can't breed in a lab a surviving herd, a brand new population to repopulate the earth. That's not going to happen. So some of your critics say, what's the point of what you're doing? You're going to breed another one that's going to live in a zoo?
Actually, there is a place for them to go. There is native habitat available for them to go. So northern white rhinos could be reintroduced. And if we only had the 5 individuals that are existing, it would be a much greater challenge. But we actually have cells from 12 individual northern white rhinos, which more than doubles the genetic diversity that we have in the extant or living population. Let's take, for example, the Przewalski horse. It was down to about 12 individuals. We were able to, through captive management, captive breeding, bring that population up and find a place that's secure for them in the wild. And we now have animals roaming free in Escanyanova, Russia.
So tell me what happens when an endangered animal, let's say an endangered northern white rhino, dies, unfortunately. You snap into action.
We do. Every second counts. As soon as we can get to that animal, we can recover the most viable reproductive cells, and we can process them and get them into the freezer for safekeeping.
You get them into the freezer just as sperm and egg. Are they combined into zygotes or stem cells? What exactly are you saving?
Well, in the case of our recent death with Angelifu, being a male, he only had sperm cells. We collected sperm cells, but we also collected skin cells, also his testicular tissue, cells from other organs in his body, all of which can be converted into stem cells.
It's one thing to take frozen sperm or egg, use it in a living animal to make offspring. It's a completely other thing if the living animals can't reproduce or are extinct to make a whole new animal. That's only been done in mice and with very limited success. So where is this headed for large animals like a rhino or a big monkey?
Well, it certainly is a challenge. The same principles that applied in producing those mice will be applied here, but we have the added advantage in that we do have sperm, and hopefully we will have eggs in the future. So we may have those native germ cells that we can do in vitro fertilization and make embryos and then do an embryo transfer into the very, very closely related southern white rhino.
You know, Dr. Durant, as I was reading about your research, I had some mixed emotions. I wonder if you share them. The science is remarkable. On the other hand, it's really depressing that it's come to this, that people like you and your colleagues have to collect sperm and eggs from dying animals in a desperate hope to preserve them with laboratory science when their habitat has been destroyed.
I sympathize with your feelings. We have those feelings ourselves, of course. But if we didn't do this, what's the alternative? Just stand by and watch these animals go extinct. There have already been many, many species that have gone extinct, not by our hand. We are not talking about bringing those animals back. We're talking about animals that are living right now that we have caused to reach the brink of extinction.
Dr. Barbara Durant is Director of Reproductive Physiology at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, otherwise known as the Frozen Zoo. Dr. Durant, thank you.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
If you've never seen the TV show American Ninja Warrior, think of it as American Gladiator meets Wipeout.
She's going to have to leap here.
Yeah, this transition is hard.
Oh! She's hanging on for dear life! Yeah, this girl is not human. She's not human!
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry brings us this story of some locals who hope to be contenders.
The show is essentially this: hyper-competitive, super-fit people completing a series of intensely physical obstacle courses. The obstacles include everything from swinging from rope to rope over a pool of water to running to the top of a curved vertical wall. That's Ricky Martinez attempting a replica of something called the Warped Wall in a backyard in West Phoenix. And the backyard, that belongs to Yoni Cajlon.
It's called the Warped Wall, and it's 14 feet high.
Cajlon trains dogs for a living, but one of his biggest goals is to compete on American Ninja Warrior. To that end, he's built a makeshift miniature course at his house, where people from around town come to train.
At first, I built it just for me because I had the time, the space, and the money, and it was something that interested me because I used to do a lot of gymnastics and cheerleading and stuff like that. So one of my biggest passions is just kind of helping people, I guess, improve themselves with their confidence in their dogs and confidence in themselves, and this is a great way to do that.
His course includes a pegboard made of baseballs and a doorknob and metal bars to grab onto or swing across.
It's just a whole lot of pieces of wood screwed together in order so that we can hang stuff and swing on it like monkeys.
There are a few foam mats underneath, padding the hard dirt. Still, it's not for the faint of heart. Falls are a regular occurrence.
Are you okay?
Oh yeah, I'm fine. Happens all the time.
Whew. But bumps and bruises don't deter competitors like Ricky Martinez.
I mean, I was doing normal things such as going to the gym, but then after a while, I knew right there and then it wasn't really going to help me as much unless I actually partook in some of the ninja-like obstacles.
How's it? I hurt my hands.
But training for American Ninja Warrior is way different than training for a marathon or even an Ironman. The obstacles are really specific. You have to prepare to do things that aren't transferable to other situations. So why choose this? For Cajlon.
I just saw that it's way more difficult and no one's ever finished it yet.
That's right. No one has successfully completed all rounds of the competition in the show's 6 seasons. Cajlón hopes to be the first.
And if not, there's always next year.
This weekend, Cajlón is hosting his own competition for locals in order to get ready for the regional qualifying auditions in Venice, California in a few weeks. Until then,
almost.
It's all about the challenge. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can see pictures of the course and video of the athletes giving it a run at kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Checking the Valley freeways at this hour, an accident on the 202 westbound at 24th Street is blocking the shoulder. There's also a collision I-10 westbound at 7th Street. Looking out our windows here at the KJZZ studios, I-10 westbound around the Broadway curve with some pretty heavy backup. We have partly cloudy skies and 77 degrees at 248.
KJZZ is supported by Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center, creating customized plans with cancer treatment options for all cancer types. Information at BannerMDAnderson.com. We are all in for the fight against cancer.
Are we alone? Is there intelligent life out there?
Well, I don't believe in this booth, but...
Mark, haven't you ever wondered, though, if it's possible there could be beings out there from another planet who have visited us? Okay, well, it's not as crazy as you might think. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins takes us to the 24th Annual UFO Congress to talk with some true believers.
Travis Walton has been telling his story for almost 40 years now.
November 5th, 1975, I was in the woods with six other men. And we were heading home from a long, hard day's work, and we spotted an object hovering near the road. I got out and went up to get a closer look, and it was hit by a blast of energy from the craft that scared my coworkers off. When they came back, I had been taken.
And he means taken away by aliens in a spaceship. Walton wrote a book about his experience that was adapted into a movie called Fire in the Sky. The movie largely dramatized Walton's abduction. He says equally, if not more traumatizing, was the reception his story first got in his hometown of Snowflake, Arizona.
Now, in the movie, it might give the impression that the entire town was against us when we came back and told them what happened, but it was actually worse than that. It was like half the town believed and half didn't. And it went right down the middle of a lot of relationships, you know.
Walton is telling his story this weekend at the 24th Annual UFO Congress in Phoenix. It's a yearly gathering of people that have reported a UFO encounter and those that study them.
I think there is a kind of people want to connect with somebody who shares an experience that otherwise makes us feel set apart and kind of, you know, it's to walk around and know something is real. It does give you a very different perspective.
The conference is not all X-Files posters, conspiracy theorists, and T-shirts with little green men. Veronica Virtus has come to the UFO Congress for 5 years. She says you'd be surprised at the kind of people you run into here.
The military, from the citizen technology sector, advanced technologies, really cutting-edge authors and researchers, and just the wonderful community.
She says while attitudes are changing, more people need to accept the possibility of life on another planet.
It bodes well for humanity that there are beings out there that have high technologies that are beneficial and friendly to mankind. I know it sounds fantastic, but miracles do happen, don't they?
Travis Walton says while it hurts him that so many have questioned his abduction story for so long, he understands why the government isn't keen about corroborating his account.
You know, they may have a point in maintaining secrecy. I think that the wider public would, many people wouldn't go to work the next day. You know, it's that kind of a thing. It would have be extremely disrupting at this point. But eventually, I think people will be ready where it's not going to have that kind of impact.
In the meantime, he says he takes solace in sharing his story and in the thought that it's not so weird to believe in UFOs anymore.
The weird person is the person who thinks we are alone.
Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The UFO Congress continues this weekend through Sunday.
The people of Finland, just like the people of Boston, Toronto, and Detroit, have coped with bitterly cold winters for thousands of years. But it's common practice amongst Finnish families to wrap up their babies very warmly and let them take their afternoon naps outside in sub-zero temperatures. Parents believe it hardens infants against the cold and makes them sleep better and longer than they would indoors. The BBC's Ilpo Salonen has more on this ancient Nordic tradition.
It's a refreshing minus 10 degrees in Helsinki. In other words, a perfect day for baby Jonas to have his two-hour afternoon nap. His parents Maya and Ilari tell me why, despite the cold temperature, they think it's a good idea.
Well, our baby Jonas sleeps extremely well outside, especially when it's a little bit below minus zero. So it's good for him and it's good for us as well. I'm getting rid of my baby weight when pushing him around in the snow.
So you think there could be actual health benefits?
Well, if the cold air itself gives health benefits, I'm a little skeptical about that. But the fact is that he sleeps really well. And I think that if the baby sleeps 2, even 3 hours a day, like really sound, good sleep outside, then I think that gives health benefits.
Mm. And he gets nice fresh air.
Yes.
Yeah. Patricia Clayhill-Siljama is a registered health visitor in Helsinki Public Health Services. She gives mums and dads advice on how to start slowly acclimatizing their babies to the cold weather.
If it's a winter baby, the baby is born in January or February and it might be cold outside, so it might be a good idea to take the baby out for just 10, 15, 30 minutes to start with. And of course also you have to use the common sense and see what kind of weather it is, and some kind of line is about minus 10 degrees, so over that it might not be a good idea to take the babies out for longer. But when the baby is, let's say, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, then the baby can take the day naps outside for roughly whatever the baby sleeps, 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, the baby can sleep outside if it's okay weather.
Erik Kvist, a pediatrician at the Pikkujätte Medical Center for Children and Youth, emphasizes that certain basic requirements have to be met.
Of course, the baby has to be healthy. So if they have fever and cannot regulate body temperature, then of course you have to keep them inside, indoors, and of course respiratory infections and so on. But if the baby is healthy, then it should be okay. We measure the temperature outside and then we put them in sleeping bags and tight clothes, and of course they usually are in a carriage or a pram and usually with a hood, so they're protected against wind, and I think that this is important.
But is there any evidence that this tradition of sub-zero napping is beneficial for a baby's health? In the experimental cold lab of the Finnish Institute of Occupational Health, where it's a crisp minus 5 degrees, I meet Professor Hannu Rintamäki. He summarizes the limited research that has been carried out, which includes a survey conducted with parents in Oulu in northern Finland.
You can see that babies sleep much better in the cold than in the warm environment. Sleeping time is 2.3 times longer usually in the cold. But the thermal insulation should be optimal, so the baby should not be overheated, neither cooled down.
Is there any research on any serious harm from this kind of practice to babies?
Of course, overheating or cooling could be possible in cold, but that kind of experiments are impossible to do, and usually the problems are so mild that we have no statistics about these problems.
And what sort of harm? Can it be damaging to their fingers or toes or noses?
Of course, the frostbite could be the ultimate problem, but I have never heard about that. Usually strong cooling is the serious what I have heard, but that means that the baby is then crying and the parents will notice for sure that the baby is cooling too much.
The survey also found that most parents felt their babies were more active and ate better after napping outdoors. Clearly babies need to be wrapped warmly, but Finns have been used to doing that for thousands of years. And the government-supplied baby box has all the basic necessities, including woolen baby clothes, tights, socks and mittens, woolen hats, a snowsuit and sleeping bag, etc.
That's the BBC's Ilpo Salonen. Happy New Year!
Or as they say in China,
恭喜发财.
Today is the first day of Chinese New Year, and you just heard Edwin Wong saying Happy New Year in Cantonese. Wong celebrated today by going to Great Wall for lunch.
And to clarify, we're not talking about the actual Great Wall. We mean Great Wall Cuisine, a dim sum restaurant in Phoenix.
If you've never had dim sum here, just imagine sitting at a big round table sipping loose-leaf tea while carts are wheeled through the restaurant.
Stacked on the carts are small metal pots. What's inside? Restaurant manager Donald Mui gave us a look under the lids.
This is a Chinese steamed char siu bao. This is a barbecue pork. This is a ha gao. It's a light shrimp dumpling. And this is a siu mai. It's a light pork dumpling. And this is famous chicken feet.
Chicken feet might sound like an exotic menu item, but Mui says they sell a lot of them.
At Edwin Wong's table, they've got a lot of the usual eats plus a New Year specialty.
And we have those sesame seed balls with the lotus paste inside. They make it for the special occasion, Chinese New Year. Supposedly, there's a good luck for the rest of the year.
It's the year of the sheep. You can also call it the ram, but definitely not a goat, Wong says. Here's his prediction for the new year.
Lamb and sheep, they are very mellow, so this is not a very exciting year. Peaceful year, hopefully.
That means this year we can all sit back, relax, and enjoy some steamed pork buns.
You can still celebrate the new year at Great Wall Cuisine. This Saturday, they'll have a big New Year celebration with line dancing and music, and of course, food starting at noon.
If you're looking for something to do on this Thursday night and you want to go down to Main Street or enjoy some Hollywood nights, Bob Seger, 7:30 tonight, the Gila River Arena in Glendale.
I'm going to turn the page on that one. It's also Arizona Cocktail Week. Festivities all day today, tomorrow, and Saturday at the Hotel Valley Ho in Scottsdale.
And Changing Hands Bookstore has the Phoenix Fabulous Mural Reveal and Storytelling event that starts tonight at 5:30.
Be sure to join us tomorrow on the show at 2 o'clock, lobbying over lunch at the state capitol, and a tiny desert concert with musicians from both the high and low desert.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian and Annika Klein, Tracy Greer and Maria Springs of the digital team. The news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is the cerebral one, John Hoban.
This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.